Hello again, I'm Anthony Stephen. I'm here with Martin Kurtzer. And so far, what we've been looking at are a lot of sort of client deployment and administration issues. We're going to take a major sort of leap forward now, and we're going to start talking about Exchange Online and DNS. And as I pointed out in the first module, DNS and Exchange Online are really totally two items that are totally integrated with Office 365. So because they are so totally integrated, you can't really cover DNS without talking about Exchange. You can't really talk about Exchange without talking about DNS. So what we did when we designed this course is we put these all into one big module and then separated them out into two. So module 5 and module 6 are going to be covering a lot of the similar sort of content in terms of Exchange and DNS. It's very exciting stuff, though, and we've got a live demonstration where Martin is going to be doing some messing about with DNS. He's going to show you some of the zone settings that we need to have configured and also look at what we need to do when we register our custom domain with Office 365. What we'll look at then, two main sort of lessons. We're going to be looking at how we add and configure custom domains into Office 365. You may also hear about the term vanity domain, but what we're really talking about here is a domain such as lucernepublishing.com and how we're going to add that to Office 365. Just a note, though, because of the way that we've got DNS set up, we are actually going to be using, instead of lucernepublishing.com, we're actually using a domain called lab01069.0365ready.com. And so that's a subdomain on the 0365ready.com domain that we're using in order to configure our DNS settings. And we have a DNS delegation between the 0365ready.com domain and our lab01069 subdomain. So that's all been set up in the background, and that's the subdomain that we're going to be configuring.
Yes, there's no smoke and mirrors when it comes to the cloud. You have to do it with a real DNS environment, and you have to make sure that it works. So you can't use a fictitious name.
Indeed, and because of part of that requirement for a real environment, this is one of the reasons why we ran course 203446 in Windows Azure, because one of the things it gives us as part of Windows Azure, of course, is a public IP address, and that public IP address is what we're going to be using, what we're going to be doing our referrals to, and it's also what we're going to be creating DNS records pointing to that IP address as well. The second part of this module, I'm going to be talking about how to recommend a mailbox migration strategy, and I'm going to be introducing this awesome flowchart that we've got, which basically tells you how to be an Office 365 Exchange Online consultant in one slide. Right, so adding and configuring custom domains then, what we're going to look at is, we've already mentioned about how important DNS is to Office 365. We'll talk about some of the DNS records that you'll be configuring. I'll take you through a sort of explanation of what we mean by split brain DNS. So if you see split brain DNS being mentioned, that's what we're talking about. We'll show how you plan your custom domains, go through the process for adding those domains into Office 365, which you need to do. We'll explain what the generic verification process is for DNS, and then bit of troubleshooting, and finish off with some recommendations. And I say, during the middle of that, Martin's going to be a demonstration of how we actually register a custom domain. Right, so DNS, well, what does it do? Well, it's all about mapping our host names to IP addresses and also possibly back again. You can do a sort of reverse DNS name resolution. So therefore, if you've got an address such as mail.lucernepublishing.com, which is the address of their mail server, then you can tie that into a specific IP address, like, say, 131.107.10.14. And that makes sure that when a remote SMTP server attempts to deliver mail for that domain, it goes to that server, whichever server has the lowest mail exchange or MX priority level. It's something that's increasingly used on both, well, external, it's always one of the basis of the internet, but also increasingly used on internal networks, whereas previously, of course, we used to use was NetBIOS, wasn't it?
Yeah.
NetBIOS name resolution. Now, there we're going back a bit, aren't we?
Yeah.
15 characters and all sorts of other restrictions. But we don't tend to use that. We don't tend to use NetBIOS internally. We tend to use DNS internally these days. So now, when you set up Office 365, your default domain is always company name dot on Microsoft.com. What we're going to look at is how you change that from company named on Microsoft.com to your custom domain, which might be something like lucernepublishing.com. So what that will then give us is usernames of user at company or at lucernepublishing.com, a SharePoint site which will be sharepoint.lucernepublishing.com. We also have a SIP domain, a session initiation protocol name of sip.lucernepublishing.com, and an external website address if we want one of those of www.lucernepublishing.com. So lots of reasons why companies are going to want to do this. So in terms of your record types then, so I'm not going to explain all of these records, but these are some of the record types that you will be needing to register with Office 365. So either A records or quadruple A records, which are IPv6 addressing records, canonical names, C names or alias names, MX for mail exchanger records, name server records, pointer records, sender policy framework records for anti-spam, service locator records, particularly that one for Link Online, and then TXT records, the text records, which are what Martin's going to be setting up in order to verify to Office 365 that you actually, or that we actually own this subdomain that we're going to be registering. Split brain DNS. Now, split brain DNS is a particular DNS type or architecture rather that is required where you need to resolve to different servers by the same name, but you need to resolve to different IP addresses depending on whether you're on the internal network or the external network. So in this particular case, this is particularly appropriate with ADFS. We've got a server farm and an ADFS proxy array. If you're inside the network, then we want the users to connect directly to the server ADFS server farm. If they're outside on the internet, we don't want them to connect to the server farm. We actually want them to connect to the proxy array. And they're going to connect to that proxy array through an external IP address, whereas, of course, they're connecting to the ADFS server farm on an internal address. The reason why we want the common host name across both the proxy array and the server farm array is to do with certificates. We basically want to issue one certificate for both internal and external addressees, and we want one URL to point to the same service location for both internal and external addressees. So this is why both the internal array and the external array both need to point to, in this particular case, adfs.lucernepublishing.com. Internally, it points to a 192.168 IP address range. Externally, it points to 131.107. But it's the split brain DNS that points them in, if they're either internal or external, points them in to whichever service location is going to be providing that service.
And a nice side effect is you don't have to teach your users two URLs. They just have to remember one URL, and they don't need to know if they're outside the network or inside of the network. They always go to the same name.
You're not suggesting that users find it difficult to remember things, are you?
No.
So it makes things significantly easier for you on the configuration side as well. The simpler things are, the less likely people are to get confused. So let's talk about planning our custom domains. If most organizations who are using Office 365, particularly with the enterprise environment, are going to want to register custom domains with Office 365. So you can actually register up to 600 custom domains with any one tenant in Office 365, but you must remember you always register the root domains before you register any subdomains. So it is the domain adding order is important. If you've got a separate root domain, then you can add that in any order. That doesn't matter. It's the subdomains that must be added after you've added your root domain. You need to think about your DNS record hosting. Who are you hosting your DNS records with? Do you know how to use their interface, the interface that they provide you to change records? And do you know what your logon credentials are to get onto that DNS environment? Because a lot of organizations seem to find that information has gone missing somewhere, and they don't know how to log onto DNS, and they don't know how to configure their own DNS records. Also, some DNS providers don't necessarily allow you the same sort of leeway in terms of recording addresses. For example, my provider doesn't let me add TXT records, but it does let me add MX records instead. And you can actually register a domain through MX records as well as through TXT records. So we need to think about making sure that we do register DNS, we both register it with Office 365 and we have access to our DNS console and to the DNS records that are in within our DNS zone. One thing to to remember is DNS record propagation takes time. Typically, it takes a minimum of about 15 minutes. It can be relatively quick, but it can take time for those records to propagate. And importantly, if you get it wrong, it can take up to 72 hours for the correction to make its way through DNS. And that's to do with the way that DNS is cached. You can alleviate that slightly by whenever you set up DNS records for Office 365, putting in a TTL, a time to live, of an hour. And that will help ensure that the refresh time is reduced, but it's not guaranteed. So what's the process then for adding domains to Office 365? Well, check you do own the domain, important. Make sure that you've got access to your DNS console and that you can actually make these required changes. So typically it's a TXT record that you add, but you can add MX records as well. And most providers do allow you to add MX records. We log into Admin Center and then you confirm ownership of that domain by adding your MX or TXT records in DNS and getting Office 365 to check. Now what Martin's going to do is say we've got a domain set up here ready for delegation to Office 365, and Martin's going to talk us through that.
Okay, so on my side, I am back in the Office 365 Admin Center and I'm going to add a new domain. So I need to go to the Domains tab here in the Admin Center. And this is where I do all my admin things regarding domains. I can buy a new domain if I don't have one, but I already have one. So I can just go ahead and add it. At this stage, so the first thing that I need to do is go through this process and say, what the domain will be, then maybe add users and assign licenses to it or set the domain purpose. So I'm going to just add the domain.
One thing to point is that you may end up in your time running this wizard repeatedly because you may want to run it according to different services. We're going to cover our services in the next module, DNS and services, but this particular case we're just going to run it through for an exchange registration.
So I'm going to just add my lab domain that I created for this purpose.
Okay. And you can see we're actually adding, this is actually a subdomain, but hopefully this, if you'd imagine Lucerne, this is actually lucernepublishing.com that we're adding at the moment.
Okay. And now I need to confirm the ownership of this domain and that I own this domain. Now, I have a few options here. I can say, well, give me the general instructions, or if I'm with these hosters, I can see how I need to configure those for them. So I'm just going to go with the general instructions because I have set up my system to do that.
And in fact, we're actually using DNS in active. This is Microsoft DNS service that we're connecting to. It's actually on an Active Directory domain controller. Yes, I know you wouldn't do that in real life, but that's the way that we've got it. So all that we need are the general instructions.
Yeah. So as Anthony said, we have two ways of proving that we own this domain. So the one way is creating a text record, which is the preferred way, and the other way is using a MX record. So I'm going to go with the text record. I'm going to just copy that value and then go over to my DNS environment where I can go and create a new other records. And I have to scroll down to a text record type. And then it's in the root domain. I just have to enter that text value in there. And it's done. So once I've done that, I can go back to this steps here and I can say I've done that. Go and verify that I own that domain. And they say, great, you've confirmed that you've owned Office 365. So very quickly and efficiently.
Okay.
Which takes me to the next step.
Fantastic. Right, so what we can do is actually stop the domain registration process at that point, because all that we've done this up to now is simply register that we own lab, that lab 01069.0365ready.com. We have shown that we can add a text record to that domain, therefore we own it. And that's all that Office 365 is actually looking for at this point. Our subsequent moves, we can do things like we can add user accounts. And in fact, perhaps if you could just show us one of the user accounts in users and groups. Just like to pop up one of the user accounts there and show us how that we've got, what we've got here is the ability now to change the domain, the registered domain for that user.
So if I go to users and groups in my portal, if I pick one of my users, then I have two options here.
Exactly. So there we can see our newly registered custom domain is actually added. So we can change Peter's logon to, instead of being a Lucerne publishing domain, but to be, you can change it to be a lab 0365ready.com domain. And this is going to be important when we get to doing DirSync, directory synchronization, because it's going to be important that that registered domain matches the UPNs of the users in Active Directory. More about that later. So this is our generic verification procedure, and this is what we've actually been through. So you can sign into your host's website, you choose your option, you add your DNX record, either a TXT, or if they don't support adding a TXT, you can support an MX record. And you could see there, I mean, that was actually very, very quick. That was straight away, because effectively we've got an instant delegation through to our DNS server. There's no sort of publication process that's going through. And that's, again, available through, that's through DNS that's integrated with Windows Server 2012.
Yes, in some organizations, this could take weeks. If you go through the change control processes of adding new DNS records in an external-facing DNS system.
Okay. And again, that was part of the reason for using a TXT record, because the great thing about TXT record is it has effectively, there's no effect on the rest of the environment. You know, you're not tweaking. You know, if you started talking about, let's add an MX record to a DNS, then sort of potentially all sorts of alarm bells could be going off at that point. Mm-hmm. With a TXT record, it's a much more easy to justify that you're doing that.
It's a harmless operation.
Indeed. Okay, so verify now, and that worked. So in terms of verifying our domain addition then, what can happen? Easily things like misspelling the domain name, misspelling the host name, not copying the text string across correctly. And in our particular case, you know, we've got O's and zeros in there, haven't we? And it's easy to make a mistake with those. Other things like copying and pasting out of documents, putting in an M dash instead of an N dash, because that actually has a different value in DNS. Replication delays, it can take time for replication to happen, so you need to allow for that process. And the fact if the domain has already been registered with another Office 365 tenant account, i.e. a previous pilot account or somebody else in your organization's already registered a tenant account for Office 365, you will not be able to register that account until it has been deregistered from the original account. And of course, if the person who set up that original Office 365 tenant account has now left the organization, then it's going to be very difficult. Contact Microsoft support to get your domain name back again. Right, so some recommendations then. You need to think about what domains am I going to register and why, what purposes am I going to use them for, and do I need to register any subdomains? Make sure that those domains aren't currently registered with Office 365. Make sure that you can actually add records, because you know DNS, these sort of DNS consoles can be very different. Make sure you've registered your roots before your subdomains, so roots always, and then subdomains, and any subdomains of those if necessary. Start going down the hierarchy. NSLookup, great tool. If it's good for looking up records, but do remember that you may need, in our environment, we were needing to enable zone transfer for the NSLookup records to be fully interrogated. Again, if you come on the instructor-led course on for 20346, you will get to do this for live, for real, in a lab. Once you've configured your DNS settings, you've confirmed, then everything should be hunky-dory and you're ready for the next phase. Mm. Oh, yes, and document your changes, please. That's really, really important with this one. Right, so we've now got DNS, we've got our custom domain. Fantastic. So what we can now look at doing is how do we actually migrate our mailboxes? And this could be from any type of server. What sort of servers have you migrated?
So I've actually seen the lot. So, you know, from POP3 migrations all the way to massive migrations using group-wise, Lotus Domino.
That's a blast.
All of them in between.
Yes, absolutely. So we've got a range of migrations options, and that's what we're going to be covering in here. But it is important to establish your migration strategy well early on. And there's a lot of other factors. I mean, I'm just giving you an introduction to this particular area. But I believe that there is also there's an Exchange Online course about this, isn't there, including hybrid.
Yep.
I'm afraid I can't remember the number of that one.
Yeah, me too.
No, right. Well, anyway, there is another course on Exchange Online and hybrid configuration. But what we're going to look at, the different migration options, including cutover, staged, hybrid, IMAP, POP3, PSTs, and public folders. And that should hopefully be enough to deal with most situations before we end up with our WYSIWYSI Exchange migration flow chart. So migration and coexistence then. So really there are... Going from one email server to Exchange Online falls into one or two of these sort of major sort of categories. So with a migration, effectively what we're taking is our existing environment and we're moving the whole thing across to Exchange Online and leaving nothing behind in our original environment. So that's a complete uninstall of whatever system it is that we previously had. With coexistence, we've got two types of coexistence. We can either have simple coexistence or cross-premises coexistence or hybrid coexistence. Hybrid was the fully featured, all singing, all dancing one that works with either Exchange 2010 or Exchange 2013 on-premises. A little bit more about that later. But that's the point to make. You either migrate or you go for coexistence. So here are our various migration options. So if you've got Exchange server, then you can either have a cutover, you can have Exchange migration, or you can have a hybrid. A cutover is where you do everything in one go. It's just like one weekend, you move all your mailboxes across, and then one weekend you make that change, you change your MX record, and bang, you're straight across onto your new environment, and you can decommission the old environment. A staged migration is a bit like a cutover, except that you do it in batches. So you move batch, move another batch, move another batch. When everybody's across onto Exchange Online, again, change that MX record, and you are onto Exchange Online completely. Or there's a hybrid where you configure your Exchange, you keep your Exchange server on premises, you connect using Federation Wizard, you connect to Exchange Online, and you move some of your mailboxes across to Exchange Online. And then you can move them back again if you want to with rich hybrid. And that's a Dersync option. Yeah, we'll be talking about that in a moment.
So that is when you want to have a very long period of coexistence and you want to run those two environments. Maybe you're not sure. You want to dip your toes again into a pilot. You move a few mailboxes. You get complaints from those users. You move them back. You move a few others and so on.
And the other one, of course, that's important with, because Exchange Online, you can have an online archive. And that's a configuration where the users keep their mailboxes on premises, but they have their online archive, or their archive mailboxes are kept online in the cloud. And again, hybrid environment enables that.
Microsoft will happily host them for you.
Indeed, yes, of course they will. So we've got some IMAP options as well. And remember that you can use IMAP with early versions of Exchange, like 5.5. And again, you can also have a simple coexistence basis, which doesn't give you quite the same level of functionality, but it does allow you to keep your existing environment. With POP mail systems, we've got things like PST migration, personal stores, and some various third-party tools, and there's like some Microsoft tools, and we've got that sort of PST sniffer thing, which goes out and finds all the PST files and brings them all into sort of one location. And then we've also got other third-party tools for POP3 and IMAP migrations as well. So the cutover Exchange migration, this is the one where it's just done on one. You do all your migrate all your mailboxes across, and then you change your MX record one weekend, and everyone's across to Exchange Online. Some limitations: maximum of 2,000 users. That's up from 1,000 from a few months ago. Things that you might need to think about are access rights to mailboxes, because you need an account that can access the mailboxes. You need to have Outlook Anywhere working. So that means public routes, public certificates, publicly published certificates. So if you haven't got Outlook anywhere working, you can't do the cutover migration. You need to think about permissions to mailboxes and also permissions on Office 365. Domains, I've already mentioned about domains. You need to make sure that you've got the same domain. You've registered your SMTP domain across into Office 365. If you've got any users on unified messaging, you must disable unified messaging before you migrate them, and then you can re-enable unified messaging. Okay, so that's a cutover migration, and really that's the simplest one. And again, if you come on course 20346A, you will get to do a cutover migration live in the lab, and the students seem to really enjoy that.
Yeah, cutover migration is really one of those simple migration mechanisms out there, but it is very powerful because it uses Outlook Anywhere, it copies all the content of all the mailboxes, and it just works. But it needs to be less than 2,000 users.
Yes, absolutely. So the next one is our staged exchange migration. So there are elements of this that are like a cutover, but we have a little bit more complexity involved because we have to set up and configure DirSync. And DirSync is what gives us our simple coexistence between our on-premise environment and our online environment. So there are things, again, there are some commonalities. You still need to configure Outlook Anywhere. You still need to make sure you've got a correct certificates. You've still got to be able to connect through Outlook Anywhere, which say requires the proper third-party signed certificates. You also prepare a number of CSV files. Each CSV file will be for a different batch of users. Access permissions are just like with cutover migration. You need to add your domain. Again, that needs to be part of Office 365, just as we've done in that demonstration there. Make sure that the user mailboxes aren't hidden, because otherwise the migration process won't work with those. And as I pointed out before, disable the unified messaging. And all that you do is you move batch after batch across onto Office Online, or Exchange Online rather, and Exchange Online keeps any delta messages get synchronized across from the on-premise environment, and they're continued so that the mailbox on the Exchange Online mailbox is always synchronized when you're in the cloud. Now, hybrid exchange, again, we're not really covering hybrid in this course. Really, what I've just got here is a simple slide that compares the feature set between hybrid exchange and simple coexistence. So with hybrid exchange, remember that's Exchange 2010 or Exchange 2013. You've got things like free busy calendar sharing across premises. You've got delegation that works across premises. You've got secure mail routing using TLS and mutual authentication. You can use the exchange management tool, admin console, to manage both on-premise and cloud-based users, and so on. And you've also got the mailbox move support for both onboarding to Office 365 and onboarding going back the other way.
A nice one there is the migration as well. When you move a user and they have these huge mailboxes, they don't have to copy their whole OST file to their machine. They can retain the OST file that they have.
Good point there. Yes, there's no OST resync if you're doing a hybrid migration. It simply just detects that it's the same user and then reconnects the same OST file. And an OST file can be like, you know, gigabytes in size, can't it?
Yeah, so it's a copy of your mailbox. So if you have a really big mailbox that we've been telling customers they should have.
Or they can have now, yes. And 25 gig, is it?
50 gig now.
50 gig, sorry, yes, of course it's updated. 50 gig, indeed.
These things change all the time.
Absolutely, yes. And then at least 100 gig on your archive, but actually it's unlimited as long as you just go and ask them for some more space. Yes, so hybrid exchange, some very, very powerful features there, and that is the sort of the top level of integration between your on-premises servers and your online servers. If you're using IMAP, if you've got some old servers, I mean, you can do IMAP with pretty well any version of Exchange if you like, but really for Exchange 2010, you're probably best to go for hybrid. What that allows us to do, as long as you've got that IMAP port open and you've got the IMAP service enabled on either Exchange or whatever it was, one of these third-party IMAP servers, then you do get migration. Do remember, of course, though, that it's the contents, it's the inbox, effectively, the mail folders that we're migrating. We're not talking about migrating calendars or contacts through IMAP. PST migration, PST files, don't you love them? They are the network administrator's friend. They're even better if you host them on a share. Then you can really, really break them.
Yeah, not supported.
But at least they're universally available around the network if you do that. But what we can do, we've got this tool. This is actually, PST Migration Tool is actually an internal Microsoft tool which has then been made available. And what it does is it goes out onto the network, it searches out through all those shares, finds these PST files, brings information on them back into a central console, and then migrates them across to Office 365. So this is really for POP3 support, where you know, even IMAP was a little bit too complicated for work. So if you've got an account that works with POP3, then this is a tool that you can use. Public folder migration. Now, do you want to tell us a bit about public folders in Office 365? Are you a public folder fan?
Yeah, so public folders are one of those things that companies love to hate. It's either a big mess or it's little. So,
and all that time and effort I put into being able to design those lovely Outlook forms on public folders. I mean, some of them are incredibly well crafted.
You know? Yes. So yeah, public folders definitely changed in Exchange 2013 and also in Exchange Online, which is now actually mailboxes that isn't hosted inside of the Exchange databases, and we have a really good high availability story for Exchange databases in Exchange 2013 and Exchange Online. So for the first time, we have high availability for public folders as well.
So basically, we're getting rid of, you know, there's no public.edb, is it? There's a mailbox which contains the public folder hierarchy, and there's one or more mailboxes that contain the public folder content, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, but now what we can do is we can migrate those across to Exchange Online as well. So if you are an organization that still has got those public folders, then you know, migration to Exchange Online is a possibility as well. It's not quite as straightforward, okay, so these are PowerShell scripts only, there's no GUI support within that, but it can be done. What you need to do is you migrate your users first before you then migrate your public folders.
Yeah, this is the last step of your migration, is to migrate your public folders to the Office 365 environment.
Excellent. Right, so some of the planning factors you need to think about. What's your current email system? How many users have you got? How much stuff have they got in their mailboxes? And this is a really great time to finally beat the drum about get rid of that data, those unused, those unread messages, those sent messages, those, you know, all sorts of gunk that's cluttering up people's mailboxes. This, you've really got to get this message across very, very strongly that users need to get rid of that content. You need to talk about, plan about things like what features are they using? I mean, are they using public folders? And in which case, how? You know, and does that need to transition across to your new environment? Are you going to be using hybrid? Because if you're using hybrid, then you can keep your public folders for at least for a while on your on-premise servers and use it that way. So what's the mail volume of data? You know, how many bits and bytes are you simply going to have to transfer across into Exchange Online? And remember that you can do that, the synchronization option, it does sort of initial migrations and then it keeps your mailboxes synchronized with the source mailboxes before you're ready to do that, right, that cutover point, and away you go, you're now on Exchange Online. And finally, your internet connection. Your upload speed is going to be a major factor in how quickly you're going to be able to move to Exchange Online. And particularly if you're on symmetric, you know, you've got 100 up and 100 down, then you're going to be in a much better place than if you're on asymmetric, you know, where you've only got a sort of an eighth of the upload speed compared to your download speed. So lots of planning factors to think about. Not surprisingly, you do need to do all the usual stuff like documenting and so on and make sure that you've got sort of management support for the decisions you're making. So here is our email migration flowchart, and we're very proud of this one because this in one page, really just one slide, tells you you can become an Exchange of Online consultant. From the start, what you need to say is, right, what's your current email system? Is it either Exchange or third party? When you say, right, if it's Exchange, which version are you with? Are you 2003 or later or 2000 earlier? If you're 2000 and earlier, then you need to go down through the IMAP route, and then you need to say how many users have you got. Whereas if Exchange 2003 or later, then you can come across to, you know, this option about long-term coexistence. If you don't need long-term coexistence, then you can go down through, down to how many users are there. And if you've got under 2,000, then you end up here at our cutover migration option. So let's see if we get a pen. Yeah, so you can have a route through here, and you can end up going down and doing a cutover migration. Or you could have a route through what is, you know, you could either, if you're going through third party and you're connecting through IMAP and you need long-term coexistence, then you can end up here. What we've done, though, is you can see there, remember I talked early on about the two options. Migration is one option and coexistence is the other. And then we have a continuum from rich coexistence to simple coexistence here. And then either with migration, there's either temporary coexistence or we're actually migrating the entire environment across that way. And there we are. So really, we've got lots of options there. I hope that's going to be a useful resource for you to make sure that you're choosing the right path to get you from your current email system, whatever that is, to Exchange Online. Okay. So to review that module then, we've talked about the process of adding and configuring our custom domains and finished off with recommending a mailbox migration strategy. I hope now that you understand some of the issues and why Exchange and DNS and Office 365 are intimately linked. You can't really talk about one without discussing the other. What we're going to do into our next module is we're going to talk some more about DNS and Exchange. We'll do some Exchange planning, look at and how we use DNS for the individual services.